Welcome to Allocation Disorder. I am Sam Staskel, joined as always by Paul Tenorio. And Paul, we're in a little bit of a role reversal situation this week. I am the person on the show that's operating on 1 hour of sleep as we record this podcast on Thursday evening. The Seattle Sounders have won the CONCACAF Champions League. I was there in Seattle last night. I am not in Seattle any longer. I'm back home in New York, which is hence the 1 hour of sleep thing. It was a late night and an early flight, my man. But history made for Seattle, for MLS. They win 3-0 in the second leg against Pumas to win 5-2 on aggregate. Crowd of nearly 70,000 at Lumen Fields. Just, man, you know, we talked last week about wanting to have a positive show. I don't think we're going to have any issues having a positive show this week, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I first of all, you know, some serious FOMO on you getting to experience that atmosphere, that you know, historic moment for the league, for the Sounders. I watched on my couch at home, and it was cool to see the atmosphere and see the celebrations and to hear the crowd during the key moments of that game, whether it was after the goals or in, you know, when the three star players of the Sounders were walking off towards the end of the game, which was the lead of your game story. Really cool experience, I'm sure, for everyone who was there. And I think that it was, you know, something that could be an important moment in league history. That's still TBD. I mean, it's an important moment in league history. Could it be transformative? It's still TBD. But I thought it was interesting that a lot of the players, a lot of the key characters from last night's game, that their answers indicated that they really believed this would be transformative. That you know, maybe other teams and other players and other organizations seeing the Sounders do what they did could spark something. And you know, I hope that's the case, because the Sounders are the standard of this league, and they have pushed the league forward before, and maybe last night's another example of them doing it again, Sam.
Yeah, so we'll get more into those questions here later in the show, but we're going to start by just kind of focusing on what went down on Wednesday night in Seattle, because it's notable on its own, and it's worth some time for sure. So game starts, and there's nerves, but the crowd is overflowing. The noise was incredible for the walkout. It was really cool. You know, we've both been lucky to be at some really cool environments and some really cool matches over the years. I was at the final in Seattle in 2019 for MLS Cup. This one felt like significantly different, in my opinion, in the buildup to the game. Part of that is because the CCL is not a 7-8 month buildup like an MLS season is. It's a 2 month, right? And what, 4 games, 8 games, whatever it is. My brain is not working great right now. You understand what I'm trying to say. So there wasn't quite as much pop in the buildup. But once game day rolled around and you start, I walked to the stadium from the hotel that I was staying at, and it was a beautiful day in Seattle, sunny, not stereotypical Pacific Northwest weather, just gorgeous. Temperature was nice. And there's people packing the bars, and it's like, okay, it's starting to build. Everyone's getting into the stadium, and you're like, this is for real. And it felt like it had a little bit more of an edge than MLS Cup did to me in the crowd, at least at the beginning of the game. Like the stakes, obviously super high for MLS Cup, don't get me wrong, but it felt a little bit different in this one in terms of this opportunity. We might not even be in this competition next year or the year after that. We don't know if we're going to be back in it. And we want to be the first MLS team to get this done, right? MLS Cup is a great opportunity on its own, but you have a shot at that every year if you're the Seattle Sounders or any other team in the league. So I thought there was a little bit more of an edge to it. And then the game starts, and things kind of went wrong for Seattle like right away. My boy Nuhu, man.
Yeah, I mean, we all were thinking of you. You know, when Nuhu went down. I mean, let's be honest. Like, how many people were tweeting at both of us just talking about the tragedy for Sam Staskel? No real concern for Nuhu's health, poor guy. Everyone's worried about
out,
your...
Turns out he was fine, so that was good.
Yeah, but we were worried about the mental state of Sam Staskel. I believe at that point in time, Sam messaged our editors and told them that he was leaving the stadium and was not going to file a game story. Things were dire. But you know what I'll point out about the first 15 or 20 minutes, what happened there, two injuries happened. Nuhu went down, and then Joao Paulo was injured. And what we know now, Brian Schmetzer just told reporters tonight that it is an ACL tear, that Joao Paulo, who was an MVP candidate last year, will miss the rest of the season. It was an brutal, incredible, by the way.
Brutal.
Yeah, it's awful. And that, awful
that
loss
turf,
for them.
That turf in Seattle has gotten a few guys now. Yeah, recently, Eric Williamson last year. I think Sebastian Blanco did his up there as well. So anyway.
Yeah, and so you know what we saw was the depth of the Sounders, the trust that they have in the players that they brought in, and Sam, we talked about working this into the podcast at some point, but I really enjoyed Matt Doyle's piece, The Blueprint on How Seattle Sounders Build Their Roster. And what I thought was funny was that it became relevant right away in this game because, you know, it ends with speaking about the depth and be agnostic about where you find your depth and the players that they had found, the types of players they had found and where they got them from. And Kellen Rowe and Obed Vargas are completely different paths to this point. Kellen Rowe, dude, an MLS 16 veteran.
Years old, Obed Vargas, coming in for the team MVP from last year in Jao Paulo, maybe the key player in terms of what he does on both sides of the ball in midfield. And was he the man of the match? Like, no, but he didn't really miss a beat, and he made some positive contributions. 16, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, no player is ready to come in after 10 minutes. You know, no one's like mentally
and
like
he,
you're
he
not
was
there.
30. He was 30 minutes that he came well, in.
But you know, a 16-year-old just popping into the game, boom, you know, into a continental final in a key position for a key player. And he didn't look like the moment was too big for him. And that was the biggest test for him to pass, right? Like there was no sense that he was overwhelmed, and he went right in there and did his job. And credit to Kellen Rowe, who was not supposed to play. Was injured, you know. I saw an Instagram post from one of his agents who was writing that, you know, they said, look, if you can give us 10 minutes, maybe, like, that was kind of the plan for him. And he goes in and plays 90 minutes, essentially, when you include the injury time of the game. So credit to him as well, Kellen Rowe, a Seattle native, Seattle area native. Mm-hmm. And but it speaks again to how Seattle built this roster. You know, a veteran like Kellen Rowe, now they're adding homegrowns who can contribute.
Yeah.
I mean, man, watch out if they start to produce more and more Obed Vargas, right? I mean, Jordan Morris is another homegrown, but, you know, I thought like this was like a microcosm of what has made the Sounders so successful.
Absolutely. And so the first half goes on. Nuhu goes out early. Jao Paulo goes out about 20 minutes later, and it's kind of a junky first half for the most part. Pumas was fouling everything. I think they had 13 fouls in the first half. So it was just really hard for Seattle to get into a flow with the injuries and with all of those disruptions. Pumas wasn't really looking to get in much of a flow themselves. They actually had the best chance of the first half for a time anyway. It was right around the 30th minute. Washington Corozo, he got in, beat Alex Roldan to a ball at the spot, and had a one-on-one with Steph Fry and lifted his shot pretty far over the bar. It wasn't all that close, but it was a good look for Pumas, and they were starting to kind of get things going. There was a set piece later in the first half where Stephen Fry made an incredible save on Juan Dineno. It ended up being called back for a foul, but it wasn't really, like, it took a while for that to set in the crowd. And the crowd, like, gave this huge ovation to Fry because he makes this one-handed, insane reaction stop. And I thought in the press box that kind of lifted the Sounders. And lo and behold, a minute or two later, you know, set piece of their own gets cleared out, recycled. Albert Ruznak played into the left side of the area. He squares the ball back. Xavier Arriaga with a nice layoff, by the way. Some solid center forward play from the center back, I thought. And Raul Ruiz Diaz hammers one, takes a big deflection, and goes in. And it's 1-0 heading into the break. And it's like, okay, they're kind of in a good spot here. So, Paul, what did you make of the first half? I mean, it wasn't the prettiest soccer we've ever seen. It's not the prettiest soccer we've seen from the Sounders in this tournament. But once again, effective.
Yeah, I mean, you'll make fun of me here for this, Sam, but I've not been getting a ton of sleep, and so I was a little worried with the late kickoff, and so I hopped on the Peloton for the first half just so I knew I would stay awake for the full 90 minutes.
You were getting your workout in. You got more fitness than Nuhu did last
night. Yeah, I did. A nice, easy ride. It was very chill. It was just like, this is the best way to get my, you know, endorphins going, so I'm ready for the second half. And I was actually getting ready to text you from the bike that before that goal happened, that I thought like it was a bad omen going in 0-0 for Pumas, because they had their chances. They really did.
The Sounders didn't.
And like it was, it felt like a role reversal, is what I was going to text you, because we're used to seeing MLS teams on the road in these continental games have chances and miss them. And then you kind of get that feeling in the back of your mind like, oh, this is going to come back to bite MLS and Champions League, right? Like, you don't put those chances away, it's going to come back to bite you. And here you are in a final on the road in front of 69,000 people. You're getting good chances and you're not putting them away. 0-0 at halftime would normally feel like a win, but in that moment towards the end of the half, I was thinking, man, they missed their moments. Like, the Seattle Sounders are not going to play like this for the second half. Like, they're going to come out firing. They're going to want to show something. And boom, the goal happens right before halftime. And at that point, it was like, to me, that was like the death of Pumas at that point. Like, but it was over.
Except it wasn't, right? And this is something that Brian Schmetzer talked about in his postgame. The first 20 minutes of the second half, Pumas were in control. And they had what ended up being their best chance of the game in the 65th minute. Stefan Fry, again, huge save. Corozo beat Alex Roldan on the dribble, got to the end line, loft across to the back post where Diogo's hanging out. And that guy is a giant. He's 6'4". He comes in full head of steam, easily wins the header over poor Kellen Rowe, who is not 6'4". And was standing still. He had no chance on that. Redirects it to the far post, and Steph Fry, his only save of the match, Paul, technically, because that one that happened in the first half didn't technically happen. he makes a huge stop, and the Sounders kind of parry away the danger. Start to settle in a little bit more, I thought, after that. And then Rui Diaz makes it 2 in the 80th, and at that point, it's done. And it's party time. And that's when it got really cool with the crowd. But we can talk about that in a second. Because that second goal, you know, we talked about the first half not being good soccer. That second goal was kind of like the Sounders at their best.
Yeah, I mean, this is a team that is deadly in transition. And, you know, transition isn't always what like the third goal was. You know, it can be... obviously, it can be moments during the game, but I just thought it showed the connection of players across the entirety of the team, you know, from the Roldan brothers through Jordan Morris to Lodeiro to Rui Diaz. And yeah, it was beautiful. It was really pretty. I loved Lodeiro's touch, the way he opened his hips up to get that ball over to Rui Diaz in stride. And
it's awesome.
He did such a nice job of kind of staring down the far post and then swinging it into the near post as soon as he saw a little sliver of space. And the celebration was killer, Sam, right? To go to the second team and the academy players and celebrate with them. That was that goal, right? Or was that the first goal?
That was the first goal.
Well, I did want to mention that celebration, because that was, to me, again, also indicative of an organization that's really well run. To celebrate with the rest of your teammates who are on the second team, the reserves.
Back it up for the people a little bit. They have the field level suites behind the goal in the north end of Lumen Field, and that's where kind of the reserves... And I can't even remember. They're still called the Tacoma Defiance, right?
Yeah, I think so.
they're still like, you have those guys. You have academy players who just won the GA Cup. They got honored at halftime of this game in front of the entire stadium, which was kind of cool. They're all back there. That's where they're watching the game. And Rui Diaz, he's flying full sprint, like leaps over the field boards, and he goes to their suite, and they're like piling on him, and it's like a sea of humanity, and that was really cool. Although I think at that point was laughing, because I don't even know who it was, but there was some Sounders player who was kind of straggling behind the rest of the group, and he picked up the ball and just punted it as far as he could into the stands.
It was Jordan Morris.
And Paul, our buddy, our former colleague, Matt Pence, was at the game last night. Oh. And he was sitting up there in that area. So I was texting him, like, did you catch the ball? And he's like, no, it was a few rows away. So anyway, kind of a funny moment there. But to your point, it's kind of Garth Lagerwey got made fun of a long time ago for the phrase vertical integration in terms of what he wanted to do with the Sounders. But that's what that is, right? Vertical integration from the first team down to the U-17s, the U-15s. So on and so forth. And Raul Rui Diaz entered the game saying it was the biggest match of his life, on the club level at least, delivered with those two goals in a pretty incredible way. The second goal, I did want to make a call back, though. you listed, I think, half of the Sounders team in your little analysis of it. You did not mention Ruznak, who to me was like, I mean, without him, that play doesn't begin. He kind of like, he got on the ball, he kind of shimmied away, he found Vargas as an outlet, and then the attack progressed from there. But I thought Ruznak was excellent last night.
Maybe the best player for the Sounders last night.
And it was so important that he was, because João Paulo goes down and he is such a focal point for what they do. And he is so steady and like so reliable. The sort of player where if you're his teammate, you know exactly where he's going to be. You know exactly what he's going to do. And you know that every single touch and every single tackle is going to be at a certain standard. Like you can just count on him. And Ruznak is the new guy. And he's played well in certain moments for Seattle, but he's still new. And he doesn't have that kind of relationship where it's like, can we count on him like this in this big moment? And he showed last night or Wednesday night that yes, they can. And he kind of, I thought, made it a lot easier for the 16-year-old that he was playing alongside by just keeping it composed, keeping it calm. And that's what the Sounders run was about in many ways, staying composed and calm through a lot of adversity in different moments in the CCL and clearing and past all of those hurdles. And ending up with the trophy.
And Sam, you know, something struck me too about the quotes after the game. And Rui Diaz, you brought up one of the things he said, but you know, a lot of those guys talked about how important that game was in their history at the club level. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've just finished up a story today. I've mentioned on this show before the interview I did with Greg Vanney, and he talked about
you finished it.
I finished it.
Way to go!
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
You know, he talked about like, you know, part of the DP structure is not just guys who can change the games. So you do need guys who can change games for you consistently with goals and assists at mm-hmm. the DP level, in his opinion, Greg Vanney's opinion. But he also mentioned that you need guys who work hard, who are bought in. One, because they're better than everyone else on your team. Like he talked
really. This is really high level analysis.
He talked here. Around that. He didn't want to come out and just straight up be like they're better than everyone else on the team. But that's what he was saying. And the reason that matters is because if you don't do the work, then you're putting more responsibility on the players who are not as good as you. And also, when you are not bought in, that trickles down to the rest of the locker room. And so what matters that the Sounders have DPs like Rui Diaz and Lodeiro who are fully bought in, who care as much as they cared and have since they arrived. I saw Garth Lagerwey's quote that Lodeiro, you had it in your story, Lodeiro is the best player in Sounders history. And Rui Diaz talking about how much that game meant to him. And
by the way, Rui Diaz coming out looking like a college basketball player.
Yeah.
He had cut some of the net off the goal, and he was coming out wearing the net on his head. Like he was going to a Met Gala or something like that. But
he's back in the MLS fashion show that they had, like the derelict fashion show that Major League Soccer did.
Wow, you can derelict my. Never mind.
But that matters, man, because like a guy like Albert Ruznak comes to Seattle not as a DP, right? He comes to win.
No, he's a DP.
Well, he's not a DP this year. Will be a DP next year, right? Or is it the other way around?
I can't.
DP this year won't be. Anyways, either way, you can buy him down, which means you didn't get him at the peak price.
That's true.
I'm pretty sure that's the case.
This is good. This is good podcasting.
This is great podcasting. It doesn't matter. The point is, Albert Ruznak went to Seattle to win, and he bought in. He's bought in already, right? Because he has to be. Because the bigger name guys who are already there are bought in. It just creates this culture within the actual group that's on the field. It's so important. And how do you quantify that? How do you find it? I don't know. Maybe we can have Garth Lagerwey on this show at some point to talk about it, or Chris Henderson, who was doing the scouting when those two players were signed. I don't know how you know you're going to get that buy-in, because I'm sure everyone feels like their DP is going to be bought in like that. But man, it really stands out when they are. And it really feels that way when you watch the Sounders. You can see how much these guys care.
So Lagerwey had a quote about it last night, and he was bouncing all over the place in every single one of his answers. Understandably so. The guy was a little bit excited. But he called it a virtuous cycle. Stephen Fry had a quote about it as well, and I'm just going to read it, Paul. And he was talking about the continuity. He said, because we have the continuity, these guys have all been together for years, for the most part. The standard that we hold ourselves to is quickly absorbed by our new players. they're integrated very quickly. That's maybe why players want to come here. You want to play for your precious few years, hopefully for trophies. And we've proven and shown that, generally speaking, we have the opportunity to get into those positions. And the first part of that quote, to me, is the key part of it, right? So you have the guys like Lodeiro and Rui Diaz, who have been there for a while and are bought in and do all the right things. And I would include Steph Fry in that group as the longest tenured sounder, who's been at the center of so many of their big moments in club history. So he's there, he's setting the tone, right? And then you have guys like Jordan Morris and Christian Roldan, who come to the club as young players, right? But are steeped in that culture. And those are their role models and examples as professionals, those three guys, right? And some others as well that have since departed, Chad Marshall, Brad Evans, so on and so forth, right? And they begin to perpetuate that culture for the guys that come in after them. And it just builds and builds and builds. And then you bring a guy like João Paulo, who very much fits that same mold, right? And it continues on, and you get it to a point where they have it now, where those young guys have now become veterans, and the young guys you're bringing in now are academy players who've been in this culture for their formative years. They already know it by the time they get to the first team. And so it can just build and build and build. It starts, as you said, I agree with this. I think it starts mainly with those designated players and hitting those and getting those right. But it trickles down all the way through the roster. And Paul, I did want to talk about the third goal as well.
I just want to briefly say before we go, you were right. Rusnak is a DP.
Oh, you looked it up.
That's good. I did. Well, you know.
Yeah.
I have to admit when I'm wrong occasionally.
I mean, I knew he was a DP. He's not able to be bought down with Tam either, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, I guess, when the salaries come out. Yeah. But
regardless, that third goal, Jordan Morris on the break, hits the post, rebound falls to Lodeiro for a tap-in. The celebration was awesome. Awesome. Like, Lodeiro rips off his shirt. By the way, Lodeiro is 33. The dude is, like, jacked. I was like, this man's still fit. This is pretty impressive. He's helicoptering it around his head. He jumps the ad boards and he goes up the stairs of the supporters section. And I immediately got a flashback because in 2019, after they won MLS Cup, he brought MLS Cup up those stairs and they were kind of like lifting it right in front of the supporters and with the supporters. And I'm like, okay, this is a nice little piece of symmetry. And I was sort of thinking he would do that again with this trophy. He actually didn't. At least I didn't see it if he did this time around. But he went up there and his teammates, he didn't even get to like the second or third step before his teammates like basically crushed him from behind. Everyone's losing their minds. They're doing the thing with the flashlights on the phone in the crowd and they're sort of turning off some of the lights in the stadium. And it was so, so, so cool. And Rui Diaz and Lodeiro are like on the ground embracing each other for like a minute. And eventually he gets up, his shirt's still off and he sort of, you know, I think he did the Messi thing. Unless I'm hallucinating that picture, where he lifted his jersey to the crowd before he put it back on. And then you have the moment, Paul, where him and Rui Diaz and Morris get subbed off for the curtain call. And what a perfect little cherry on top of the sundae, I thought. Another deafening roar from that crowd, which was awesome the entire game.
Yeah. Cool night. Cool night for the Sounders. Deserved night for, again, I've said this before, I'll say it again, the best franchise in Major League Soccer. They've done the best job. They've been the most consistent winner. They've pushed the league forward time and time again. They did it again last night, and it was fun to watch. That is the best advertisement for Major League Soccer you're going to get. That team, that crowd, that result. I mean, that's what the league is hoping for all the time, and you know that's why the Seattle Sounders are, you know, the team to watch in Major League Soccer every time they play. You know, they put on a show.
Most successful team in MLS since they came into the league in 2009. And they're still going. They ain't stopping anytime soon, it looks like. And by the way, credit to Brian Schmetzer as well. I don't know if we've really talked about him, but that culture stuff, a lot of that, like a lot of that is down to him as well. And I think that it merits mentioning. So credit to the entire organization. Paul, you just said it. Class of MLS, most successful team, but the best club, I think, for me at this point, probably in MLS history. When you talk about on the field, off the field, the entire package, what they've done over the last almost 15 years now, pretty much without peer. So we'll talk more about what this means for Seattle, for MLS, They have a Club World Cup that's going to be played at some point in the future in some country far, far away. That'll be interesting. So we'll talk more about that in the next segment. Stay with us.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Welcome back to Allocation Disorder, talking Seattle Sounders, CONCACAF Champions League. First segment, we talked all about the Sounders. What an incredible achievement, and what a moment for that club. But Paul, what does this win mean for Major League Soccer?
Yeah, I mean, I think even my mind changed a little bit watching the game last night and listening to the way people talked after the game. Like I said earlier in the show, like I've always felt it has the potential to be transformative. I've wanted to emphasize the potential part of that statement, but in, you know, out of respect to our attempts to be more positive, like last night was cool to see. And if it was cool to see for journalists and fans, and it was fun to watch, and you people wanted to be there, I imagine that there's a bit of envy going around the league right now, you know. And I hope that it serves as motivation for clubs. The question is it serving as motivation for clubs that, you know, are like only Atlanta and NYCFC and Toronto and LAFC, who are already doing these things that are trying to push the league forward?
Already motivated.
Or does it serve as motivation for teams like Colorado and Dallas and San Jose, and who you can make your arguments for Dallas and you can make your arguments for Philadelphia of their model for success or whatever they
Colorado
want to success.
Too, for that matter.
Yeah, but in Colorado as well. But like, to get to that next place. And like, Sam, I'm sure you're going to say this next, but like, I'm not the only one who thinks that, right? Like, DeMarcus Beasley wrote a column on MLSsoccer.com where he kind of voiced that too. Like, it takes another level of ambition to compete at the higher levels, to compete with the best teams in Liga MX, of which Puma is not one. Pumas is not one, by the way. But to win these tournaments, that's what it takes, what the Sounders have done. Ambition with a real desire to compete at that tournament. And now they're going to go to the Club World Cup and they're going to be on a bigger stage. Major League Soccer is going to be on a bigger stage than it's ever been before. And we'll get to this a little bit later, but that's a big moment for the league too. That holds real implications. And so, I don't know, after watching last night, man, my hope is, do I think that this opens the door for potential growth? Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know where it'll go from here, but my hope is at the bare minimum that it's pushing Atlanta, New York, LAFC, those teams who are already trying, Toronto, that it pushes them to that next level to say, okay, how can we be more like Seattle, or how can we turn what we've done in New York or Toronto to get to that next step? Or, you know, Greg Vanney in LA Galaxy, where he did it in Toronto and wants to replicate it with the Galaxy.
So I have a couple things that I want to hit here, and hopefully I can maintain some level of organization with my thoughts. We'll see how it goes.
I didn't do well at that.
So the first part is, will this change? Is this going to be a watershed moment? No one knows. Everyone knows that if it's going to be, it's going to be because MLS teams stack victories. And this is repeated. And I think we can say now, Paul, that the teams like the Sounders and like the LAFCs, the ones that you just rattled off, they have the potential and the ambition to go win the final, right? And it just sort of comes down to what's the draw and what happens and all of these things. And those are kind of random, and no one can really predict them. But they have the ability to go do it. So that's A. I think what I'm comfortable saying is what it will change is the ambition of those clubs, which is what you were just talking about. And I think it'll change as well the vibe of this tournament and how Mexican teams approach it. And I think that these things taken together will elevate everything, right? There was a big element, and there's some vocal people on Twitter basically like being like, Pumas blew it for Liga MX, which is ridiculous on a few different levels. But the main, I guess, motivation there is that they wanted to save face. No one wanted to be the first Mexican team to lose this competition to an MLS team. And Pumas ended up being that one. And so next year, right, Liga MX is probably going to come back like firing. They're not going to want to lose this 2 years in a row. And so that is going to then demand that the MLS teams bring it even harder. And that's a good thing for the overall competition. Stefan Fry had a quote after the game. He was like, you know, I'm sure there's more than a few teams around MLS right now that are pretty mad that it was us that did it first, right? The whole Seattle invented meme, right? They get to lay claim to this one. No one can take it away from them. But I think there probably will be some frustration that other teams didn't get there first. And I think that will push teams forward. And I think what you saw in the stands last night and what you saw from Seattle is big, right? Because part of the CONCACAF Champions League is educating fans about it. Like, I remember when I worked at Real Salt Lake way back in the day, this was 10 years ago, and Real Salt Lake, that fan base knew more about CCL than any other in MLS at the time by leaps and bounds. They had made the final in 2011 and lost. But I remember putting together like content for the group stage, and like a big part of it was like explaining what the group stage was and how the tournament works. And there's still an element of that even today that the Sounders were doing ahead of this game with some of the marketing stuff that they were putting out there, is explaining why this is important. I think with the win, there's a lot less of that. Right, it becomes more front of mind for your casual MLS fan. It becomes more front of mind for your player. I think the Latin American players in particular have always been super into this tournament in MLS. I don't know that the American players always really, really have, at least not to that kind of overall level. I think that'll change with this. So I think you'll start to see teams really go for it more. And that gets to the point that Beasley made in his piece that he wrote for MLSsoccer.com. And I'm just gonna quote him. He says, "It's hard for me to believe that this is the start of a new era in the CONCACAF Champions League for MLS clubs, especially when a Mexican team has appeared in every final since the tournament moved into its current edition in 2008. I think the individual player is getting better as far as quality in the league, but I'm not so sure about the ambition of the clubs." Which, I mean, apart from being a wild sentence to write on the league website.
There's one person who doesn't get that line edited out of their column, and it's DeMarcus Beasley.
As someone who used to work for MLSsoccer.com, I guarantee you that I would not have, that sentence would not have survived if I had tried to put it in there in one of my pieces. But he's right. You need to go for it. And he talked about it, like being in this tournament with the Dynamo and how they just weren't equipped And so they didn't really try. And like, that's fine. But you see the Sounders, they're not doing well in MLS right now. They're probably going to lose this weekend at Dallas. And they're going to have a hole to dig out of. But I don't think anyone in that club is going to feel bad about that. I think they'd make that trade every day of the week. And so I hope teams go for it more. I hope you start to see more of like, I mean, a European style environment where Champions League becomes like the thing next to the championship, and they're sort of on equal levels. And I think that this gives the opportunity for that to happen.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about the Latino players maybe appreciating the tournament more. It's because they grew up in a culture where those tournaments existed and mattered. Libertadores, Copa Sudamericana, you know, and so there is that tradition that exists the same way Champions League does in
Europe. And the Club World Cup, by the way, big thing for those guys because they can go play against those clubs that are winning Libertadores.
It's a proving ground for those players. And in this case, it's going to be a proving ground for an entire league. And that's really important. You know, the next layer of this, and Garth Lagerwey was talking about it last night after the game, is like, it's so cool. We're going to play Liverpool in a game that matters with stakes for a trophy.
Paul, he was like bouncing up and down.
I saw it.
When
I
he
saw
was talking.
The video.
Did you see the video?
Yeah, I saw the video.
He was like giddy. He was like a kid on Christmas morning.
He's right. It would be really cool to see an MLS team play Liverpool in a game that matters, potentially. And like, Sam, we were talking about this before we started recording. Like,
Before you go further here, I think we have to say if an MLS team plays Real Madrid in a game that matters,
yes,
that they would probably be winning like 4-0 heading into the 85th minute, and they would lose 12-4, right?
Well, whatever happens, the point is like, it will be a really important moment for the league. You know, it makes me think of the texts I get from my friends who played soccer growing up, like know the sport, understand it, played at college. Some of them played at the college level. And knowing that I covered the U.S. men's national team are texting me during games, like when the U.S. was losing to Panama, I'm getting text messages through like the terrible Wi-Fi, like, what's going on with this U.S. team? Is like,
by the way, always more texts when they're losing.
Always. But like, that was what was informing, like, they were like, what is up with this team? What's up with Greg Berhalter? Like, they weren't tuned into all the things that we're tuned into, right? Our world at that time, especially, was the U.S. men's national team, just like our world is always MLS to a certain degree. And we're so tuned in that we're like, oh, like, who cares if you lose to Liverpool 7-0? Like, it's Liverpool or it's Real Madrid. But like, for the casual fan, not just in the United States, but in this case around the world, that will be their impression of Major League Soccer. That will be how you get measured up. And even working at The Athletic, it's provided this really cool perspective in a way of our colleagues in the UK and how they think of the league that we cover. And we learn about it sometimes in the stories they write, like when Wayne Rooney left DC United to go to Derby before he became the manager. And they were writing about it like, will he be able to cut it at Derby after playing in MLS, which is a lower tier significantly than the championship?
And did he leave before Zlatan went back to AC Milan?
I don't know. But I was like a little bit offended because I was like, you could have at least like, you know, sent us something. But like, that's how the perception is, right? Like, they don't know the level at all of MLS. And it doesn't matter, like, there have been all these interviews from players who have played in the championship and played in the US who say, you know, who can speak eloquently about how the levels compare. But like, the casual fan doesn't know that, right? And so this is a huge moment for the league. And I'll say this again, I would not want any other team in Major League Soccer to have this moment, to be the one going over to represent the league. Like, I have the most faith in Seattle to get a roster that looks worthy at least of being there, that can be competitive. But I think it will be a really important moment for the league.
We've already seen Nuhu shut down Mo Salah once.
Right. what a real rivalry that's forming now.
Yeah, between Nuhu and Mo Salah.
Yeah, a real legitimate rivalry, you know? It's like the Liga MX MLS rivalry.
I mean, Arriaga, maybe he's played against Firmino in CONMEBOL. You know, like Lodero, maybe he's played against some of the South American guys on Liverpool. and come or Lucho Diaz.
Maybe Allison. maybe one of their dads, you know. I don't know. Like,
yeah, maybe one of their Rui Diaz, you know, maybe he's played against some of these guys. Hey.
No, but on a serious note, Sam, it's going to be an important moment. And I think in that way, like you're talking about educating fans about why this matters and what the role of CONCACAF Champions League is important because it's a measuring stick. And that's where mm-hmm. the struggles for MLS in CONCACAF Champions League have mattered. Because you can't sell to an audience that you're a growing league, that you're a league of choice, that you're an improving league, if you can't beat the Mexican teams.
Can we, hold on, can we ban League of Choice?
No. This is the podcast of choice. It's on our Twitter profile, which was a great call by you. This is the podcast of choice covering the League of Choice.
I was talking to our friend David Gass, who those longtime listeners of Allocation Disorder will remember was with us on the first episode of the show.
Yeah. Once the OGs. I don't think that ever... Did that publish? It might have published.
I think it did because you got in trouble for it. Anyway, we were talking in Seattle and I just wanted to give him a shout out because he played a large role in the naming of the show, which has an incredible name and I don't think he's ever gotten the proper credit for it. So shout out to Dave Goss. But Paul, to your point about the Club World Cup, I look at it as an incredible opportunity, right? Like, if they go out and they get smacked by Liverpool or Madrid, like, those casual fans that pay attention to soccer but have no idea about MLS, that's just fitting their opinion already, right? So you're not really losing much there, but you have so much you can gain, and that's a really cool thing. I did want to mention one other thing. I think we talked about this maybe last week. I don't know. It's all bleeding together. But if you start to win this tournament more and more, and the better you do in this tournament, and the better you do in Leagues Cup next year, the more that Liga MX fans that live in the United States that don't necessarily pay attention to MLS, the more they have to take MLS seriously, I think. Or not have to, but the more some of them will, right? And for a league like MLS that needs more fans and needs a larger audience, that's an audience that's right here. Can you take it, right? That could be really important going forward.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I think I've made this comparison before, but I still think of MLS as UCF. And like UCF fans,
Bortles.
Yeah, because UCF fans, they didn't really exist.
So who's the Bama in this analogy? Just so we can like benchmark.
Nobody. At Liga MX is Florida.
There's no Bama.
No, Liga MX is Florida, Florida State, Bama, whatever you want to say. The parents went to those schools, and the kids that went to UCF were fans of Florida State and Florida. Yeah. And when they walked around campus, that's the gear they wore. And what happened was UCF became a good football team. And they started to have fun atmospheres. And the students went and watched a winning team. And they became fans of UCF. And they stopped wearing the Florida gear and the Florida State gear. And now the first generation of those fans has graduated and is starting to bring their kids to games. And their kids are being raised as UCF fans the same way the Florida and Florida State parents raised those kids as those fans of those schools. And UCF is one of the biggest schools in the country. And so that fan base is growing and growing and growing.
And now they're going to the Big 12.
And now they're going to the they will be the biggest school in Florida, and it's only a matter of time and numbers. That's all it really is. And MLS is fighting that
the school
same
of choice
idea, right? They don't have the history, just like UCF didn't have the history. And the Liga MX fans, they're fans because their parents were fans, and their parents were fans.
To this point, we saw people at the stadium last night, not just in Pumas gear, and there were a lot of Pumas fans, but I saw people in America jerseys, Pachuca jerseys, Atlas jerseys, Santos Laguna jerseys.
Yeah, and it's hard to turn those fans, right? You grew up on that team. Maybe you tune into a game here and there. Maybe now you go to a Sounders game if you live in Seattle. I'll check it out. But their kids, that's who you're aiming for, that next generation. You're saying, we're worthy of you watching us and becoming a fan. And in order to do that, you need to start to show that you are relevant, that you matter. And that's the competition that MLS is trying to figure out. If you want to watch a soccer game and you live in Chicago or you live in Seattle, your choices are limited. You go to a men's professional game or you can go to a women's professional game and you can watch in Chicago, you can watch the Fire or you can watch the Red Stars. Those are your choices. But if you want to watch soccer at home on TV, you can turn it on and watch whoever you want and become a fan of Liverpool or Arsenal and that's your club. Or you can... If you're
Boca Juniors or
right.
anybody,
Bayern Munich. Or if you're a young Mexican American kid, then you say, no, I'll just watch on TUDN with my dad and I'll keep watching Atlas or Chivas or wherever, from whoever you're from, whatever team you want to pick, right? And MLS needs to start turning some of those fans into MLS fans. And these are the moments that you can do it. These are the moments that you can say, okay, start paying attention to me. And so it's, to me, it's less about getting the established Liga MX fans to turn on MLS. I mean, you hope that that happens, but I think it's less likely. But it's more about, can you start to build some of these newer soccer fans, whether they're newer because they're young or they're newer because they are coming to the game, into fans of their MLS teams that will watch these games. And I believe that part of it, not all of it, but part of it is relevance internationally, showing that you are competitive. And that's why last night was important. That's why Club World Cup will be important. That's why sustainability of success in the Champions League is important, and the League's Cup.
The most important.
Yeah, and the League's Cup too. These are these little moments, and it's clear that the league understands that. Let's show how we stack up. Well, you better win. You better win if you're showing how you stack up.
Yeah. And we'll see. We'll see how it progresses. There's still a long way to go. You know, I don't think we've mentioned really that the richest Liga MX teams were not in the tournament this time around, which makes a difference. But, you know, I think what you said, Paul, was really well said just there. And credit to Seattle again. Because, and hopefully more teams push like they push. Because that moment, Wednesday night, not just the game, not just the win, but 70,000 people downtown in a stadium that isn't a soccer-specific stadium, but it's not a soccer-specific stadium either. And the whole city's behind it. And it's just so cool, man. Like, I think you and I sometimes forget to take a step back and appreciate that. Because we grew up, you know, watching this league. We grew up, not even grew up, but grew up as journalists, going to games, covering games in this league. In 2009 was my first year covering the league. First year the Sounders came in too. And it didn't look anything like this, I can tell you that. And it still doesn't in most cities around MLS. So to get a moment like that last night where it's big time, legitimately, just so cool to see that and to be a part of it in some tangential way like you and I are. Hopefully we see more of it going forward, because that's ultimately what we all want.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Welcome back to Allocation Disorder. We have talked for 45 minutes about Champions League. We're not quite done yet, though, Sam.
Almost.
Grant Wall reported in his newsletter that Garth Lagerwey, the general manager of the Seattle Sounders, is out of contract at the end of the year. Because of the unique situation that Seattle, the way that they work, there will be a
democracy
vote by the fans as to whether or not to retain Garth Lagerwey.
I think I like his odds.
It would be crazy if he didn't come back. But Sam, this is a GM who, in our anonymous survey of soccer executives, received 13 of 21 votes in first place. The next closest person received 2. Not very close. No. He is considered far and away the best general manager in Major League Soccer, and he could potentially. No, not he could potentially. He will be a free agent at the end of the year, I guess, unless he signs an extension before the end of the year, which I don't think can happen with the vote. Right? I don't know.
I don't know exactly when it is. I know it's happened in the past as the season has been going on, in October. So it could happen after that, before the playoffs, or I guess that'll be mid-playoffs. I would expect that the Sounders do everything they can to bring him back. It seems like he's enjoying himself up there.
Yeah, I mean,
the interview last night was certainly a wild ride.
I watched that interview and him talking about the Club World Cup and how cool of an opportunity it was, and I was like, okay, Garth is going to re-sign in Seattle. But I think it's worth pointing out that if you look around the professional sports landscape, it's in this country but around the world, when there is a top executive in a league, like, there are attempts to poach that executive and to latch onto that executive and to hire that executive. I don't know that that's really happened with Garth Lagerwey, and it surprises me. And, you know, I know from our reporting, from my own reporting, you hear whispers of like this team might be interested or that team, but it's not like been an overwhelming, it's been a murmur of like a team here or there.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Again, I come at it from a point of
Garth Lagerwey did get poached once upon a time.
Right. A long time ago.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
7 years ago.
Now. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this, as an example, like, he's a Chicago native. The Fire had an open CSO job a couple years ago and didn't speak to Garth Lagerwey at all. That's crazy.
I still don't even have words for
like
that.
To not even have the conversation
To not even reach out and ask if you can interview him.
Right.
I mean, it's
wild. I mean, he's the best GM in the league. At the bare minimum, wouldn't you want to have that conversation to kind of hear how he does things? So I'm interested to see if anything picks up for him.
Why would he? So here's what I don't have words right now, but let me try and find them. If you're him, you're in Seattle, you have the best team, you just won Champions League, you're in the Club World Cup, you're not going to leave just to go be a GM somewhere else, right? You're going to need a vertical move. Like, you're going to need to be running the entire show. And to me, it's been strange that he hasn't gotten that opportunity yet, because we've seen it for other, Tim Bezpachenko in Columbus. John Thorington is now, I believe, co-president along with a gentleman on the business side, as well as GM at LAFC. I don't know. Are there any others? I can't remember.
I don't know. Paul McDonough had Porig
Smith.
Both. Porig Smith. Porig
Smith. I believe his title is club president in Colorado.
Paul McDonough had both in Miami. It's a slippery slope. It's a huge. Those are huge jobs.
Yeah.
I think that how you execute those jobs, what you ask
but
of that
those,
person.
Those three guys that I just mentioned, they're all doing pretty well with it, right? Nelson Rodriguez had it as well. You have to delegate. You have to staff up around those people because you can't do those two jobs by yourself. So, but if you're him, why would you leave for anything less than that?
But my question is, if you're a team in MLS, why wouldn't you be offering that? That's the bigger question.
I don't know.
It makes sense for Garth to be turning down jobs left and right. It doesn't make sense for Garth to not have his phone ringing.
I don't know, man. Like, I don't know. And who knows? Maybe Vegas gets in the league. Maybe they try and make a move. I don't know.
I don't know like, that there's like, there's probably a list of like three or four teams that I could say, okay, they shouldn't have to call Garth Lagerwey.
I think it would be pretty crazy if Seattle didn't move heaven and earth to keep him.
Well,
but I guess we'll see.
I don't disagree with you.
The Sounders fans could vote him out and it could be moot. I don't think that'll happen. But Paul, we have more to get to in this segment. Another positive story for MLS and American soccer. Jodis Park opened in Nashville, 30,000 seat soccer specific stadium. Awesome crowd in their opener against Philadelphia on Sunday. Really cool looking stadium. Pablo Maurer was there, our colleague. He has a story on The Athletic about it. I haven't had the chance to read it yet, but I talked to Pablo about it. I'm excited to read it and kind of get his impressions from that. Nashville also made some news before they opened the stadium when they announced that they signed two DP deals, one an extension for Hani Mukhtar, maintaining that status, and one a new designated player in Walker Zimmerman. And Paul, you wrote a story about this. Why don't you take it away, my man?
Yeah, this contract matters because it has league-wide implications. Walker Zimmerman signed a new DP deal that will pay him $10 million across 4 years, $2.5 million a year. This is a significant amount of money for a player who has never left Major League Soccer to go to Europe.
It's a lot of money.
It is essentially unprecedented. Jossie Zardes, Darlington Nagby, and Jesus Ferreira all make DP money, all less than $2 million a year on average. So you're talking about a pretty significant jump there at a position in general that hasn't gotten paid in Major League Soccer as a center back.
Though it's changing.
It's starting to change a little bit. But what I think matters here is this is a player who developed Major League Soccer, has been traded twice in his career, and has kind of grinded through that. And now I think there are circumstances that led him to leave Dallas to go to LA that were different than LA to Nashville. He was totally caught off guard by moving from LA to Nashville. I think the move from Dallas to LA was a little bit of a mutual decision there. But, you know, here is a guy who, two-time Defender of the Year, three-time MLS Best 11, fought his way into the starting 11 for the U.S. men's national team and then wore the captain's armband when they qualified for the World Cup in Costa Rica. Just a cool story in general for an individual, a player who has worked to this point. And again, in our anonymous survey, was the top pick by GMs around the league for the player that they would most want to start a roster with, that they were starting a team from scratch. It shows his value in the league. And he got paid in a big way. And that money, that price is going to change that position. It's going to change the valuation of center backs in MLS. And Sam, you and I were talking about this earlier this week, before, I think right after the Walker Zimmerman story published. And, you know, you're already starting to see a little bit of a trend in MLS of teams paying more money for center backs. NYCFC signed a DP center back, Thiago Martins, this offseason. Carlos Salcedo is around $2 million a year from what I'm hearing. Houston signed a DP center back. So,
teenage Hadebe, yeah.
So we're starting to see some money, some serious money get spent at that position. But this will have a major impact on the market for two players. Aaron Long, who's coming out of contract at the end of the year and will be a free agent, and Miles Robinson in Atlanta, who's younger. Both of them are in the national team pool, Long and Robinson, as well as Zimmerman, of course. And I don't think either of them are going to be looking for a contract that's less than $2.5 million a year, which is interesting. And what I think it highlights is the impact of the salary cap and of the limitations of the buckets and the fact that different teams have different models. And in Nashville, the model fit perfectly to give Walker Zimmerman a DP contract. They can afford to do that. The way their model works, he is the most important player on that team to the way that they want to play, the leadership role he plays, the marketing role he plays in Nashville, and it worked for them. For Atlanta, those DP spots are designated for multi-million dollar transfers from South America for attacking players. That's the model in Atlanta.
Unless it's a temporary one, like Alan Franco, who later got bought down with Tam.
Yeah, and so it's less, they are less able to pay Miles Robinson DP money. Red Bulls, interesting one. Their model, I think, would give them room.
Is pay no one.
Right. Their model is there's definitely room to pay Aaron Long as a DP if they want to, but they have been very reticent to actually pay people what they're worth, to pay big money, and to spend much at all in Major League Soccer, at least, you know, since Jesse Marsh came in as coach and kind of flipped the model from the Thierry Henry, Tim Cahill teams.
They spent a lot on Kaku back in the day.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see. And you know, Atlanta's limited in what they can do with Miles Robinson at this point. They either have to get him to agree to a TAM deal, which would mean paying him.
He's already on one, I believe.
Right. But basically, the max he could do over the next couple of years is somewhere around 1.7, 1.8 million. So 700,000 per year less than what Walker Zimmerman's making. Mm-hmm. Or they have to sell him, because there are no internal transfers in Major League Soccer. There's no way you're going to have enough GAM to trade for Miles Robinson in this league. And so, I think it would be very difficult to match what you could get internationally on the low end for Miles Robinson with what you could do in GAM realistically in this league.
Well, you would get more GAM from within the league, because you only get so much. You know, it's capped at a million for a transfer.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about actual money that matters too.
But what's their motivating factor there? Who knows? Maybe they care more about the game. We're not having that conversation, right? So I think with Robinson, it ends probably with him moving on abroad, to your point. I think with Long, he's at an age where I don't think Europe is in the cards for him. really interesting test case for MLS free agency. If there's a history there that isn't great with him and the Red Bulls and him wanting to go to Europe and him wanting new contracts and them taking a long time or not letting him go. So I wouldn't be shocked if he just wound down his deal and maybe moved on elsewhere.
And Sam, the most interesting part to me is if you read, we don't have the long form of the new CBA yet.
By the way.
Soon.
Has it been ratified?
Yes. It's literally just the long form is being finalized. And I think we'll see it soon.
Okay.
But I made some calls to kind of get an idea of how free agency works, what the teams are being told of the rules are of free agency in this new CBA since we don't have the written rules. And what I was told is essentially what the CBA says is if the contract fits these parameters where we see those caps on how much a player can make, I think it's something like 12.5% of, you know, the previous year's salary up to at least 500,000, whatever. It's very confusing.
How much money can Aaron Long make?
Basically, it puts him somewhere around $1.3 million per year because he makes about $1 million.
If he leaves the Red Bulls.
If he leaves the Red Bulls. But the language only says that the league cannot veto a deal at that amount of money. What it doesn't say is that he can't make more with another team. It's just that the league has the power to veto that deal.
Very interesting.
So, you know, the league, what'll be interesting is how much power do the teams have to push back on the league and say, no, this is how we want to spend our money.
How big are the checks you're writing? I think there's a direct relationship there.
Yeah.
If you're paying a 9-figure expansion fee and you want to sign Aaron Long for $1.9 million instead of $1.3 million, you can probably throw your weight around with the league office in a pretty meaningful way.
And I think what we know is, like, you know, historically the league has pushed back hard on that and has tried to prevent contracts. When TAM first came around, this happened a lot with American players.
It's a big story, yeah.
And if the owners are finally putting their foot down and saying, I want to spend my money this way, and if you're going to allow the bigger teams to spend $10, $12, $15 million on transfer fees for guys who sometimes work out, sometimes don't, who are you to tell me I can't spend $700,000 more than you want me to spend on this guy, who I know what he can do? That is an interesting dynamic to keep an eye on here in free agency.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's sort of opening Pandora's box a bit, right? If you start to say, who are you to tell me how can I spend my money? Well, then you're sort of calling into question the entire construct of the roster rules, right?
But in this case, it's not breaking a rule. It's just
saying that you don't have veto power. That's the next step.
Sure.
It's okay, well, why do I have to spend it on 3DPs? Why can't we just spread this across the entire roster?
We're there. We have at least one owner who said that on the record to me.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't so long ago.
So we're at that point already, and that's why, you know, here we have another interesting test case. And at the end of the day, this is what happens when you have these billionaire owners, to your point, Sam, coming in, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on expansion fees, hundreds of millions of dollars opening stadiums, hundreds of millions of dollars building training facility, and they have somebody calling them saying, no, we can't approve this deal. We don't like the terms of the deal. And the owner saying, I don't think that's going to work for me. And I think we're approaching that. I think we're at that point right now.
Paul, you know what's going to work for me? MLS team, Seattle Sounders, CONCACAF Champions League champions. That works for me. Congratulations again to Seattle for their achievement. Really excited to see what they do going forward. Really excited to see what MLS teams do going forward in this competition. I think this raises the level for it. Anything else you want to say here before we sign off about the Sounders or about anything else? Oh, you did have a note on Greg Berhalter and something he told Steve Goff.
He said to Goff, Cameron Carter-Vickers is going to get called in. Haji Wright's going to get called in. Looks like John Brooks, perhaps not. Also, you know, alluded to a dual national who could get called in. So it'll be worth keeping an eye on who that could be. The last time.
Is it you?
It's not me, sadly. But I do think that, you know, last time, let's not, you know, undervalue Greg Berhalter's ability to recruit. Last time somebody came out of nowhere, it was Yunus Musa, who nobody thought was going to leave England, was captaining the U19s for the England national team. He's going to play against England in a World Cup for the U.S.
Greg Berhalter's got that sick NIL collective going, man. What can you say?
Yeah.
Oh man, he's got all the shoe deals lined up for the guys. Makes all the difference in the world. Anyway, congrats again to the Sounders. Congrats again to you, listener, for making it through this show. We appreciate you. I'm Sam. He's Paul. This has been Allocation Disorder. Until next week.